So for those of you who were looking forward to hearing from Tim today, the lead pastor here at Hydrant, I am sorry to disappoint you because he is not here. He and Anita have gone to, actually, out of all things, perform a wedding. So they are going to be coming back soon, but in the meantime, he asked if I would be willing to step in. I don't really know if I've signed up for something I'm quite prepared to do, but nevertheless, I'm with you this morning, and I'm thankful. For those of you that I have not met, my name is Dustin. For those of you who it's your first time here, if something I say comes across weird or uncomfortable, good news is I won't be back up here for a while, so you'll get to see a much better-looking, more adept speaker than myself that has about 12 inches of facial hair that stick down here. So I couldn't grow an inch of facial hair if I had 3 years to try, so thank you for being here with us today as we work towards the end of this sermon series that the month of April has kind of encapsulated, the matters of the heart. Matters of the heart. I find it interesting that we use the term matters of the heart because it really does matter how our hearts get invested in relationships. And we've heard up until this point three more eloquent than I can put sermons on singleness from Liz, on dating from Tim, and that movement that goes from dating into marriage. And I'm thankful to have a chance to speak with you this morning about that fourth and final stage, that marriage, that commitment, that covenant and most sacred of experiences that we as humans, I believe, can have this side of heaven. See, as we prepare this morning, I have to admit that I'm a bit nervous. See, when Liz brought that message a few weeks ago, I wasn't here, admittedly, but I did hear it on the app. She brought into perspective what it means to be prepared emotionally, mentally, physically for the relationship that you will one day potentially enter into as you're single, getting to know yourself. And then Tim came along with a message on intentional dating, and he dispelled so many myths that our culture will put as far as the way that we date. And then last week we talked about covenant marriage versus this marriage that is not covenantal but is consumer driven. This marriage that says that this is what I want and this is what I need. And so we go to these marriages and we try to find satisfaction in another person, but yet never fully find that. And so today we're marking the fourth and final sermon on this series that I admit I'm terrified to speak on. Because the truth is that I don't know that I'm qualified to speak here. Perhaps what I am qualified to do is for the next 20 to 30 minutes to keep your attention for better or worse. And so I want to do that by beginning in a place in my life and in my world a little over a decade ago, a time that many of us will relive and some will regret and some will smile at it, a time when I was in high school. See, 13 years ago, I graduated from high school. That feels like such a long time ago. That means that 17 years ago, over half of my life ago, I entered into high school. Now, like I said, high school could have been the best or worst of times for any of you, but the truth is that we all have some vague memory of high school, whether it be something that we want to tell about to our kids or something we probably regret even thinking that we ever did in the first place. But when I think back to high school, I think of one thing in particular, and that was baseball. See, baseball for me was the thing that I spent the biggest amount of my time and energy and effort into. And baseball was, well, part of my life. But here's the thing about baseball. I was only good at one thing. Now, how many of you in here are fans of baseball or softball? I know Steven is. Steven talked to me for 30 minutes earlier about how he broke Lexi's bat over his knee when he got mad. So we'll talk about that next time, but so baseball and softball is this unique sport that takes a lot of time and money. In fact, how many of you in here like watching baseball? I see less hands, whatever. Or softball, I guess. have to be fair. I admit, I played baseball for 13 years and then coached for three. I can't watch a game. It takes too much time. It's a slow and deliberate paced thing, and at the end of it, you're like, man, I just watched 4 hours to find a 1-0 score in a game that I probably don't care about. And see, if you're like my wife right now, I've probably already lost you, so she doesn't care about baseball and doesn't care about softball either, but hang with me for a moment, because what I want to tell you about is my time in high school and my experience with baseball, because when I was a high school baseball player, I was a pitcher. Now, I was not MLB draft material, but I was better than some, probably not as good as most, but pitching was something I was fairly adept at, but like most pitchers, I couldn't hit. It was terrible. In fact, in the 4 years that I played high school baseball, I had exactly 11 at-bats. Guess how many hits I got out of my 11 at-bats? One. I was 1 for 11 in high school, which means my high school batting average was a whopping 0.91. Now, anybody in here going to be happy with an average of 0.91? Probably not. ERA, maybe. Yeah, you're right. I don't even remember what that was, but we wouldn't be happy with that. But here's the thing. When it comes to baseball and softball, you know what we are happy with? We're happy when we fail more times than we succeed. Think about this for just a second. Some of the best baseball and softball players that we know of had averages that were more failure than success. Look at David Ortiz. His lifetime batting average was a 286. Look at one of my idols, Sammy Sosa. He was only a 273. Even the great Bambino himself, Babe Ruth, was only a 342. When we look at some softball players, Dot Richardson, she was only a 289. And Lisa Fernandez, one of the best collegiate batters in women's softball history, was only a 401. That means that even the best players when it comes to baseball and softball fail a minimum of 6 out of 10 times. But on average, more than 7 out of 10 times. And we still consider them to be successful. Now, does that make sense? Not really. But yet we accept that because we know how hard it is to get up there and swing at a small ball, or a little bit bigger if you're softball fans. We know how difficult it is to make that action happen. And we see the effort and the energy that's put in by these players. We see the time and the commitment that's put into it. And so we look at those averages, a 273 or even a 400, and we say, well, it's more failure than success, but yet it's wildly successful. So this morning, I need to disclose something about myself. See, when it comes to marriage and my participation therein, I'm much like Dustin in high school when I played baseball. Truthfully, I get it wrong more than I get it right. I get it wrong so often that if you looked at my average in marriage, you would probably consider me to be a failure. But what if we begin to look at marriage a little differently today? What if we look at it the way that we quite possibly look at baseball and softball batters? When we look at that average and say, you know what? Maybe there's something more behind those numbers. Maybe there's more commitment. Energy. Maybe when those failures happen, that's one more way that we figured out how to do it wrong so that we can learn to do it right next time. So maybe this morning as we approach this marriage thing, what we need more than anything is just to know that it's okay when we get it wrong. Maybe we need to hear the fact that we're all from time to time failures in marriage. So if I've lost you with the sports analogies, I apologize. But if you would hang with me for just a little bit, because today what I want to do is be able to look at some of the common failures that we have in marriage in order that we might be able to learn to do it better. As we approach that today, if you would pause with me for just a moment as we take a second of silence to allow the Spirit to open this place. Will you pray with me? Father, may our hearts be open, our minds be curious, and our conversation to be fruitful. We love you and trust you, and it's in your name we pray. Amen. So over the last 4 weeks, we've worked our way here. Liz began with singleness. Tim gave us advice on the pitfalls of dating. We looked at what marriage really could be. Last week. And see, the day has now come and we're finally here. In fact, we know it because we've seen the flowers decorating the sanctuary. We know the groomsmen and bridesmaids have all been fitted for their attire. The camera person has been paid an extravagant amount of money, by the way, so kudos to camera people. There's always that one groomsman, too, whose suit inevitably didn't get picked up on time, and that one bridesmaid whose measurements have changed just a little bit since she was originally fitted. But the day is here, and 500 of our closest friends are surrounding us, loving us, supporting us. Let's get married. But see, what if marriage is more than just that wedding and that day? What if marriage is so much more than just that day one? If it's day two, three, and four, and God willing, years five, six, and seven, how do we do marriage right when we start to take those steps? See, marriage is not exactly like it's portrayed in movies or TV or even within written literature called books, for some of you who may read books. Marriage is hard. It's difficult. It's something that we get wrong more than we do right. Even Christian marriage, which seems to be something so elementary, we get it wrong more than we do right. And see, as we work towards that, and we find that commitment is something that we have to go through day in and day out and renew every single moment, we find that, well, there's big things sometimes that we get wrong. And if I'm being honest, I'm the worst at this. And see, I get marriage wrong in habitual ways, in patterned ways, in ways that seem to be again and again and again. I'm not proud of it. I wish it was different. My hope is that maybe it is a bit different today than it was yesterday. But I don't want to just make a holy point up here today. I don't want to just give you a bunch of scripture that seems to speak to what we should do in marriage and make you feel so terrible that by the time you walk away you think, gosh, I can't do it. I want to be honest with you and tell you where I'm at. And so friends and family, the truth is this, I fail at marriage. But the thing is, I don't stop there. I don't stop at that failure, and I don't let that failure define what that marriage can become. In fact, like my time in high school when I played baseball, I continued to take batting practice regardless of whether I was going to get an at bat. I continued to swing and continued to grow, but I also continued to watch those who did it fairly well. I tried to gather tips, pointers. I listened to my coaches and my mentors who tried to improve me, and they had a task on their hands with that. But I worked at it. And I worked hard. And I worked daily in order to try to attain something that, whether I ever got there or not, I was going to put the effort in. And so what if marriage was like that for us? What if we worked that hard? What if we translated those same ethics into what we do between our spouse? What if we continue to pour love and effort into it? What if we continue to watch those who do marriage particularly well? What if we have those people in our lives, those coaches, those mentors, those friends that we could talk to, that we could share with, and that we could get advice from? What if we had those things? See, as I asked myself those questions this week, I recognized something. I recognized that in my life, I do have those things, and I do have those people. So something that I did over the last couple of weeks is something that I've never done in a sermon before, but it's an opportunity for me to be able to include voices that are better at this than I am. And so I reached out to my mentors, my coaches, my friends, and I asked them a very specific set of questions. I asked them, what does it mean to be in a healthy, godly marriage? What are some characteristics of marriage done well? What are some pitfalls and shortcomings that I should avoid? Good news is that I've got a lot of really good coaches and mentors because they responded to me. They responded to me in mass. And so I had all of this narrative and all of this data that was allowing me to be able to see with eyes that were better than Dustin's, to be able to hear with ears better than what I was equipped with, to be able to know and understand far beyond my own small world what it means to have a godly marriage. So what I want to do for you today in just a few moments is be able to relate back to you that which they told me, to be able to tell you those characteristics, to be able to share with you those pitfalls, to be able to give that advice back that I got from those whom I trust more than anything. So what I'm going to do is something I've never done before. I'm going to use a dry erase board. Tim does it. It seems to work. And I've got these three large biblical narratives that I want to interweave into this story to be able to show you some pitfalls in Scripture. In fact, some people who were really godly individuals that from time to time did it wrong. And then finally, I want to give you the last piece of advice that they gave me and a piece of wisdom that I believe will tie everything that we're going to do over the next couple moments together. So, if you're a visual person, I hope that this board helps. If you're not, I apologize and just use your ears. But I want to begin today with the first theme that came out of the conversations that I had with my friends, mentors, and coaches. And it's a theme that's simply titled, The Blame Game. The blame game. It starts in Genesis chapter 3. You probably already know the story. If you don't, then I'll tell you that Liz did an amazing job when she spoke 3 weeks ago on being able to articulate Genesis chapter 1 and 2 when God creates man and woman and calls them good. Man and woman are in this good place, this garden, but then something happens. See, something happens in that garden when a period of time is transpiring, but then comes a suggestion. The suggestion comes at the hands, or really rather the mouth of the serpent, and that suggestion then moves into a thought, and then that thought becomes an act, and that act becomes betrayal at the hands of fruit. Now from that fruit's juice comes eye-opening wisdom, but not wisdom as the man and woman thought that they were going to get, not wisdom as they wanted, but wisdom of vulnerability, of shame, of nakedness, wisdom that then moves to a divine inquiry. That divine inquiry then takes God in a way, and he comes down and he begins to question the man that we now know as Adam, and he says to him, "What have you done?" Adam, not wanting to bear the burden of that shame, that guilt, that nakedness that he now feels, does exactly what I was warned against by my friends and mentors. He begins to play the blame game. In fact, what he says is, "It wasn't me, it was her." How many of you in here have played the blame game? I'll see a few timid hands. Most of us, if we're being honest, have played that blame game. Yeah, I hear some laughter. You don't have to show. I've played it. See, when I I begin to ask my friends and mentors, my coaches, what are some things and characteristics that you would warn me against? One of the things they said is that marriage is not about keeping score, because if you do, you both lose. They said, don't throw the other person under the bus and never put your marriage on probation. A third said, look, it's simple. Take personal responsibility. Like I said, the blame game. See, Adam in this story wants nothing more than to not feel the anxiety and the worry and the fear that comes with having to answer the question that God asked. What have you done? He says, look, it wasn't me. It was her. You know, it was this woman that you gave me. Ooh. In fact, he blames God for giving him the woman. In the blame game, then Eve blames the serpent, and it just goes forth and goes on, just to show that if we don't take responsibility for what we've done, who will? How do we grow if we never confess our own shortcomings? How do we recognize those faults within ourselves if all we ever want to do is offload the anxiety of taking responsibility on to the other person? If I'm honest, this is one of the biggest failures that I have in my marriage. It's that moment where I speak poorly to my wife, but then I say it's because of something she did that made it come out in me. It's that time in which I defend or I deflect or I justify my behavior because of what someone else did to me. The blame game is rooted in who I am, that it becomes this primary mechanism of defense. But like that mentor said, if you keep score, everybody loses. If you don't take responsibility, you don't win. You just all feel the pain. Jesus picks up on this in the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew chapter 7, when he's sitting on the side of that mountain, he says to the people, he says, look, why is it that you always see the speck in the other person's eye, knowing good and well there's a log in your own? In fact, if you want to see clearly what's going on with them, first remove the log from your own eye, then maybe, just maybe, you can see that speck in their eye clearly, and you can help them better. See, the blame game says there's something in your eye while missing the fact that there's so much more in my own. See, if we decide that we want to live godly marriages, then we have to cease and desist the blame game. But the blame game is not the only place where my mentors and friends came back to me. In fact, the second theme that they kind of brought out is one that I'm simply going to title this: Get Behind Me. Now, Get Behind Me may touch a little bit on our nerves. Because Get Behind Me is something that, well, I'll give it in a metaphor with middle school boys. So every year I get a chance to volunteer at a camp up in Black Mountain that's part of the denomination that I'm ordained in. I've done it every year since I was 8 years old, and for the last 13 or 14 I've been a counselor. And I've noticed a pattern with middle school boys that is consistent regardless. It's that moment where we're all in a group and the dinner bell rings, and a middle school boy will take off like Usain Bolt at the Olympics, jumping over whatever's in the way, hurtling through, juking people as like fluid as you can, even pushing people out of the way just to get up there to get a plate of chicken tenders and a small cup of Kool-Aid. You've seen it before. It's that moment where that me first attitude gets in the way, that me first, I want this before you. It's that moment in life where we treat our spouse as if we're better than they are. See, when asking this question, I received several responses within this category, with with all of them summing up, "Get behind me." Some of the responses that I had were from people who were like my parents. The wife said, "Put your spouse's needs in front of your own, regardless." And her husband said, "Love with a desire to please the other one without failing." Another said, "You both share one heart. Why not put their half before yours?" Another even said, "Fight for them and not with them. They are not second place." See, last week, Tim made a statement in his sermon that I've thought about over the last 7 days when he said, when two people come together with me in the center, the only thing that can happen is war. Nobody wants war. But you know, the truth of it is that folks like myself, folks like us, every single day, come to the table thinking only about me. And we say to the other person, "Get behind me." See, there's a story in the Old Testament in the book of Genesis of a man named Abram. We probably know him better as Abraham, but in Genesis chapter 12, when we're introduced to him, he is only known by his surname Abram. Now, Abram is an individual who is told by God that he will have great wealth, great property and prosperity. He will have children in his old age, and his name will forever be remembered. He's given all of these promises, but then something happens. See, in Genesis chapter 12, beginning in verse 10, we hear about a famine. Let's pick up the story from there. "At that time, a severe famine struck the land of Canaan, and it forced Abram to go down to Egypt, where he lived as a foreigner. As he was approaching the border of Egypt, Abram turned to his wife Sarah and said, 'Look, you're a beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Let's kill him. Then we can have her. So please tell them you're my sister. They will spare my life and they'll treat me well because of their interest in you.' Sure enough, when Abram arrived in Egypt, everyone noticed Sarah's beauty. The palace officials, when they saw her, they sang praises to Pharaoh, their king, and so Sarah was taken into his palace. Pharaoh then gave Abram many gifts because of her: sheep, cattle, goats, male, female donkeys, male, female servants, and camels. But the Lord sent terrible plagues upon Pharaoh and his household because of Sarah, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh summoned Abram and accused him sharply. 'What have you done to me?' he demanded. 'Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister and allow me to take her as my wife? Now then, take your wife and get out of here.'" Now, imagine with me for a moment that I turn and look at Danielle and I said, "Look, here's the deal. You're beautiful and I'm a little bit nervous about that. But here's the deal. If I tell everybody you're my sister, they're going to hook me up with more stuff, more money, more prosperity, more reputation. I don't know what they're going to do with you, but I'm going to be good. So can you please tell them that you're my sister?" You think she's buying that for a moment? Sounds crazy, right? But think about this "get behind me" in a little different way. Think about it when we get a little bit of extra income into our house and we don't really tell our spouse about it and we go spend it. Think about when we make decisions that affect both of us, but only one of us actually was involved with the decision making. Think about "get behind me" and that attitude that we embody over and over again that says, "Well, I love you, but I kind of love myself more. I'm going to look out for my skin, not necessarily yours." We all know about "get behind me." See, the Apostle Paul, as he wrote to the church in Corinth, said a lot about the marital relationship. He talked about the selflessness of love. He talked about how we should be people who lack arrogance in our relationships. But then he says to the people in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 10, he says, "Don't seek your good. It's not about you. But seek the good of your neighbor." So if we're seeking the good of our neighbor, shouldn't we at minimum seek the good of our spouse? See, if I'm being honest, this is another place that I fail. Like those middle school individuals, I want to be first in line. Like Abram, I look out for my skin first. like the church at Corinth, I want to seek good for me, even if that means putting my spouse behind me. I fail when it comes to get behind me. There's a third place that those mentors that I spoke with in the last couple of weeks directed me towards. And this is a hard one. This is one that starts so innocently and grows so fast. I'm simply going to title it this: Don't Go There. Don't go there. See, don't go there operates under the assumption that there's somewhere that you should be that you're not. Don't go there operates as if what you're going to do is going to inevitably lead to a place you don't want to go. There was a children's song that I learned when I was in elementary school and in Sunday school that taught me this concept. It said, "Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. Be careful, little feet, where you go." See, the things that we touch, see, and go to affect us. When I asked my friends, they said these words to me. One said, "You need to know yourself and know your surroundings so that you don't end up somewhere with someone or something that you would not want your spouse knowing about." A second said, "Marriage has been a learning curve for me. I've had to learn where my spouse's level of comfort is." A third said, "Commitment in all things, not just when you're being watched by the other person." Don't go there. In the book of 2 Samuel, we hear about a man after God's own heart named David. David is at this point in time now king of God's people. And throughout the entire first part of Samuel, we hear about how he's made this growth. He's been wildly successful in everything that he's done. Pretty much everything that he's touched has turned to gold. He's been a person who has vanquished enemies. He's been a person who has united both the northern and southern kingdoms of God's people. He's even brought their most holy of all artifacts back into the people's possession. But then we hear chapter 11. Chapter 11 is where things start to go wrong for David. See, in chapter 11, we hear these words. We hear that it was spring, in the time of the year when all the kings go out into battle. All the kings except one. See, David had remained at home during this time. And according to this narrative, he has just woken up for a nap and he's walking around on his roof. And as he looks around the roof of the palace, he sees another rooftop in which a woman is bathing. Now, this woman is beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. And she is in all of her glory there bathing. And so David, who already has multiple wives, but recognizes that polygamy at this time is not forbidden, takes interest in her. In fact, he goes as far as to send someone to inquire about who she is and what's her story. And they come back and they're like, "Well, her name's Bathsheba, but she's married. She's married to an individual in your army named Uriah." Now, David at this point in time probably should not have already gone there, but here he's already here and he's already made this step. And so instead of stopping, David decides to take it a little bit further because, well, he's king. And in the ancient world, being a male of power, and a male who owns a kingdom, you make the rules. So what does David do? He requests her presence. In she comes. He sleeps with her. She goes home. All is forgotten about for at least a couple of days until word gets back to David that this woman who you have taken, who was married, is pregnant. He's gone there. He has gone there, and now he has to go even further because in order to try to make this right, he decides to request her husband's presence back. back into her home. He sends word out to the army, and he says, bring Uriah home. Bring him back so that maybe he can go home and take some rest and respite. And maybe he'll sleep with his wife, and all will be well, and we won't have to worry about this thing. But Uriah is a man of great faith and refuses even to return to his house as long as his brothers in arm are still in the battlefield. So David tries once, twice, three times to do this, and he recognizes Uriah is not giving in. So he turns to the next step in his plot. He sends Uriah back to the field with a letter in his hand that literally reads, send Uriah to the front of the line, and as soon as he gets there, back away and leave him exposed. What happens is murder. David has Uriah killed, you know, in a way to cover up that he went there. See, don't go there is a hard place for us to recognize. It starts so innocently, so casually, and it grows so fast. Don't go there, because once you have, it's hard to stop. For many people, failure in marriage happens because they went there. And by going there, they were tempted. And when that temptation led to action and those actions led to consequences, they had to react and so forth and so on. See, according to the story, David should have never been there in the first place. He should have been out with the kings, but he wasn't. He should have looked away, but he didn't. He should have given up once he found out that she was married, but he pursued her. He should have never invited her in, but yet he did. He should have repented and asked for forgiveness, but no. He should have offered restoration. That didn't happen. He should have told Uriah the truth, but no. All because of what David did when he went there. The consequence just kept going. See, I want to offer a side note here, too. When Danielle and I spoke about this part of the message earlier in the week, she asked a question that I had never thought about, but yet one that needs to be addressed. See, the question of why doesn't Bathsheba play a part in this? Why didn't she just say no when David enticed her and invited her in? Doesn't that make her equally guilty? Well, honestly, probably not. Because understand this. In the ancient world, when you had power and you were powerful, you made the rules. And when you were a male, you were powerful. When you were a male ruler, you were even more powerful. When you were the king of a nation, you had all power. Bathsheba can't say no. She's being ordered by the king. Which leads to a subpoint in all of this. How do we use our influence sometimes to go there? Jesus, again in the Gospel of Matthew, kind of picks up on this point in the 5th chapter. When he's talking to the people from the side of the mountain, he says to them, look, if your eye is causing you to sin, then we'll cut it out and throw it away. And your hands, you really don't need hands if they're causing you to stumble. Drastic and crazy, perhaps. But yet, Jesus is onto something by saying this, because the truth is, if we don't guard ourselves from don't go there, it only takes a look, a step, a touch, and you went there. Friends and family, don't go there. The fourth and final point that I want to make today that came out of the conversation that I have with my mentors is one that we all know and yet still get wrong, and that's simply this. Communicate, but communicate well. See, let me ask you another question. Have you ever been in a conversation with your spouse and all you wanted to do was tell them to shut up because what you had to say was more important? Has that happened today? Remember the blame game. We can't play that now. Have you ever been that person that when that person is talking to you, all you are thinking is, your stuff is important, but mine's more important. That's poor communication. The truth is that we suck at communication. We're not taught how to communicate well. We know how to talk verbally, but what we don't know how to do often is how to listen. See, in Proverbs 15:1, we hear these words. We hear that softly answering will turn away wrath, but harsh words will stir anger. And in 12:18, we hear that rash words are like swords, but the tongue of a wise individual brings healing. The psalmist puts it this way in chapter 19, "Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, Lord." Learning to communicate well takes a lifetime. We either get better or we get worse. And truthfully, if we take those other three categories, we can probably put them as bullet points under communicate well. Because if we learn how to communicate with our spouse and how to communicate well, then we won't play the blame game. We won't say to them, "Get behind me," and we won't go there. See, my mentors put it like this. They said, "Talk with each other daily and don't assume that your spouse can read your mind." That's a tough one. Communicate verbally and non-verbally, both with word and action. Speak to your spouse how they would like to be spoken to, not how you assume that they would like to be spoken to, not how you would like to be spoken to, but how they would like to be spoken to. Finally, they told me that communication is not about each person giving 50-50. But it's about each person giving 100%, 100% of the time. Learning to communicate well. See, as I said before, if I'm honest, these are places where I struggle and I fail. I would like to say that I have a better average in marriage than I did when I was in high school, but my wife is sitting right here and will probably tell you that I'm just full of it. But the truth is that I can take these lessons that I have been given by folks that I've watched that are particularly adept at doing godly marriage well, and I can apply them into my life and in my relationship. And maybe, just maybe, next time we talk, I've gotten a little bit better. I don't know that perfection will ever come, but I promise you that no one gets up to the plate in any sport, whether it's baseball or softball. No one steps up to that free throw line in basketball. Nobody sits behind a center and expects to fail. We give and we give all that we have. We learn from our mistakes. Our failures don't have to define us moving forward. And if we're ever going to grow, then we need to be willing to start at this place today where we say that we fail at marriage. Because if we're going to grow out of that, then God needs us to be honest with ourselves. So maybe this morning was not what you expected. Maybe it wasn't as exciting, or maybe it wasn't quite as in your face, or whatever. But my hope is that what it does is it's created a pocket of space in your life with your significant other that you will be able to use to communicate better, that you will be able to use to have dialogue and conversation around the blame game and how we fall into that, that you'll be able to talk to one another about getting behind me. And finally, you'll be able to safeguard your actions, words, and deeds and not go there. My hope is that this message today will offer you that place to start, and that next time we speak, things have gotten better. So if you would, as we end this morning, will you pause with me for just one more moment so that we can remember what it is that God has allowed us to be when it comes to matters of the heart? Will you pray with me? God, it matters because you've told us it matters. And these matters may be difficult or uncomfortable, but yet they're still matters of our hearts. So teach us how to be people who discover who we are in our singleness, people who date with intentionality, and people who work our way into marriage deliberately. Finally, God, teach us that our failures don't have to define us, but they can simply be a place where we learn and grow. Give us the strength to do what it is that you've called us to do, and keep us today. For it's in the name of your Son, Christ Jesus, we pray. Amen. Thank you for being with us and worshiping with us today. Enjoy a homemade cookie on your way out, and we hope to see you again soon.